David Young, welcome for the first time officially at any rate to Lyric and as the new chorus master of the RT Philharmonic Choir. It's a great pleasure to have you here at the start of a new year and an exciting time for you. But I wanted to ask you just to start off with, you've an incredible range of experience as a choir master to call upon in your relatively short career so far. But I wondered if there was something different about working with something like the RT Philharmonic, maybe in a way a little like the Royal Scottish National Orchestra Chorus that you're also very closely associated with, but choirs ostensibly that have this association with a major symphony orchestra. Is there a special calling?
Yeah, definitely. The first difference is that most of the groups that I work with, I conduct the concerts. So I prepare them for something and then I also lead the projects all the way through and conduct the concert and perform it in the end. But here, what I do is I prepare the chorus and then somebody else comes in during the week who's working with the orchestra for the orchestra. It could be the music director, Jaime, or it could be somebody else. Like this week, we've got Patrick Ringborg conducting us. And so I've just prepared the choir and then this week I take a backseat and I pass them on to him and hope that they do well.
One of the things that's interesting about you and that we learn very quickly is we kind of think of the choir in a very traditional structure of soprano, alto, tenor, bass, whereas you choose to talk about grouping the choir according to vocal colour. I'm very interested by that. What does it mean exactly?
Well, the choir is still completely structured in those terms. It's still soprano section, alto section, tenor section, bass section. And within that, there's higher and lower voices. But not all voices are sort of created equal. You know, we all have an individual and a unique voice. But there are types within that that sort of have more similarities with one another. So, for example, some people might have been having singing lessons for 20 years and have very developed voices and have a very sort of strong, rich tone, maybe with more vibrato, more body to the sound. And some people might have a less sort of developed voice or a more of a sweeter, clearer sort of a lighter tone to it. They're different colours of tone. And so we've started using colours. It's not actually, I wasn't the first person to bring this in, but the choir has been using this as a way of sort of basically deciding where everybody sits, that we put the stronger voices towards the centre of the group is the principle. And then it sort of radiates out from there in terms of how rich or how full-bodied, it sounds like I'm talking about wine, how full-bodied the tone of the singers is. What that means is that if you were to put somebody with a very light voice next to somebody with a sort of darker, a heavier voice, it might mean that the person with the lighter voice, their contribution was a little bit lost in the group. And the principle is to make sure that everybody's voice is heard in the blend, in the mix, in the end. That's the idea of it, is to make sure that everybody gets heard and try and sort of find the best way of arranging everyone to produce that result.
And does that mean that people, that members of the choir end up standing where they least expect to be?
Yeah, it can work like that. One thing that we will do in the future is instead of sitting with all the sopranos next to each other, all the altos next to each other in a big block, we'll mix that up so that people are just sat next to any voice part. So rather than being sort of part of a big homogenous section, they have to use their own individual voice more. They can't rely on the people around them to help them because they're singing something completely different. And what that tends to get is people listen more for the bigger picture of what's going on rather than just their own voice part. That can help with things like tuning, and it can also help with things like the blend of the sound, with getting all the same vowels through the whole choir. And it also means that everyone has to take responsibility for what they're doing as well, which sometimes it's easy to kind of sit back and let somebody next to you take the strain sometimes.
So be warned, no taking any auditions for the RT Philharmonic Choir lightly in any way. You know, I'm always fascinated by the possibility of the very defined sign or tuning that you must have within your ears. Very quickly, you have to be able to hear things that I imagine no one else can hear.
Well, the thing which is complex about any sort of conducting and what you're listening for is that there's so many different things that you're listening for at the same time that, yeah, there's this sort of fine detail listening where you want to be able to say, well, this note is a little bit flat within the chord, or that note is a bit sharp, or the balance is not quite right here. But more important than that is always obviously the big picture stuff. And I think the challenge is not so much having the pair of ears which is capable of listening to each of those things, or the brain which is capable of picking out the individual things. It's being focused on all of them at the right amount, at the right time. So knowing whether now you're listening for the line or the colour or the tone, now you're listening for the detail of the intonation or the way that they're speaking the text or what vowel it is, or whether you're just listening for whether it sounds vibrant and whether it feels like they're really making music and bringing something to life rather than just singing the notes on the page.
You know, we hear a lot about choirs these days. It's so integrated into the sort of general community well-being, mental health and all these things. But one of the things that does seem definite about the choral tradition is that it is capable of enormous change. For example, we're told that Benjamin Britten wrote his Missa Brevis for George Malcolm and that he was credited, for example, of changing the character of English choral music in the late 1950s from somewhat hooty-type sound to something much more definitive. Do you see it as something that's constantly evolving?
I think I would like to see it as something that was constantly evolving. That sounds like a really appealing concept to me of things always being moving. I find that actually a lot of the time we're still doing the same things that we were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even in some cases 100 years ago. I'd be interested to know, I mean, it's impossible to say really, even listening to recordings, you can't get a real sense of this, how people would have rehearsed this piece that we're doing at the moment, the Dvorak, 50 years ago or 100 years ago in a choral society in the UK or over here. You know, how people would have actually prepared that, how they would have talked about the music, what they would have talked about with the way that they produced the vowels, what was important for them about the way they shaped the music. Is it the same stuff? Are we talking about the same bits and pieces? Was it more, is it more conceptual now? Are we more thinking about ideas and about images behind the music? Are we thinking more about nuts and bolts now? I'm not sure. I think that one of the difficulties is that there's so little kind of conversation about how we do it. Like, for example, I don't talk with many of my colleagues about how I prepare things or what I'm doing. It's only quite unusual that I get the chance to have that conversation or to see somebody else working. So it's very difficult to get this kind of, to really exchange ideas, I guess. It only really happens when you're younger and you're singing for other people. Because these days I don't have any time really to do any singing.
You started as a chorister, presumably.
Well, I started as, I guess where started is, where was the start is the question. But I started out with playing the guitar. That was the first thing that I was doing. I played electric guitar and rock bands and stuff when I was at school. And that was my way into music. I'd had piano lessons when I was younger and my parents loved classical music. But I wasn't a chorister, like a sort of small boy chorister. That I never did that. I got into classical music only when I was about 17 and I started listening to well, I guess it was pieces like Debussy, Prelude à la Promenade in Faune and Wagner and stuff like that that I heard that was not like what I thought classical music sounded like, and it just kind of opened my eyes and my mind. And then I started singing because I had to do music at my school. I had to go and join the school choir. And from there, I sort of fell in love with it. And then, yeah, I started out singing. I started singing when I was 17, 18, and then when I left school, I went to go and do singing in the cathedral in Manchester and with the Halle as well in Manchester. And it was, yeah, the first bits of professional work that I did were as a singer when I was about 21, 22. That was my first professional music making. And conducting came quite quickly after that as well. I always knew that I wanted to do it.
You know, a lot of what you're saying speaks to me of communication equally as it does, say, of a musical background. And one of the things about being a chorus master that's interesting is that as opposed to any other kind of musical director, you're working necessarily by people who are doing this for love in their free time, generally speaking. They're not doing it for money. And therefore, that requires a very particular type of, well, sensitivity, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I actually think that there are more parallels between the way that works best with amateurs and the way that works best with professionals and some of us as conductors tend to think. I think that people tend to think that you basically have to be positive and encouraging to amateurs, and you have to sort of bring them along with you. You have to get people really involved in what's going on, and you have to persuade them that it's worth doing, I guess, and make it fun for them because it's a hobby. Whereas the professionals, they're paid to be there, so they do that. And also, you know, they're professional musicians, they love it so much that it's fine. But I don't know, my experience is that often those of us that work in the profession can be the people who need the most enthusing, actually. We need things to work in a sort of slick and professional way, but then so do amateurs as well. But we also need to have people who inspire us, because we're so used to making music that sometimes it can become a little bit like, well, that's just what it is. It's a job. And I think it's easy for us to forget that it's also a passion.
We touched earlier on the work that we're hearing tonight, a very epic and apocalyptic work, really, Dvorak's Requiem. It's interesting, the question of Dvorak and these memorials, these elegiac works, and thinking of things like the Stabat Mater, for example. The one thing that we're told about Dvorak again and again is that one of the reasons he was so popular during his own lifetime and in his own country was because of his endless optimism, and that somehow he managed to express that nearly all of his music, even in these highly emotive works that are inevitably weighed down by bereavement.
Yeah, that's interesting. The piece has a lot of different characters to it. Yeah, apocalyptic is definitely a word for particularly the first half of the piece. There is a lot of the Day of Judgment. There's a sort of recurring idea, which is quite violent, that comes back a couple of times through the piece. The second half of the piece in particular, but all the way through, is permeated with this kind of sadness, I guess, a sort of like a sense of loss rather than a sense of desperation, but a sense of sort of a deep sadness about something that has inevitably happened that we can't change, which is, you know, there's not many ways of thinking about grief that resonate more directly with me than that. It's this kind of, you have to be resigned to it. There's nothing that you can do about it. There's no way you can change what's happened. And I think that one of the things about grief is that it never leaves you. You just learn to live with it when you've lost somebody. That's my experience of it. And I feel that that is present in this piece. So I realise I've taken the point away from optimism entirely, but it doesn't feel like an entirely optimistic piece to me. It feels like a piece which knows that there is a sadness and is happy to live within that, or is capable of living within that. But the end of the piece, I want to talk about the end of the piece a little bit. It's a very strangely ambiguous conclusion. The choir and the soloists at the very end of the piece, there's a little coda, there's like 8 or 10 bars after they finish. And when they finish, it feels like it's such a beautiful cadence, the way that the choir comes to rest at the end. And it feels like you've gone through this transformative journey from the very dark minor beginning of the piece with that melody that keeps coming back, that the very beginning of the piece that starts with the ya da 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 ba. It's in the piece about 200 times, that melody, in various
different
forms.
It runs from beginning to end.
All the way through, from beginning to end, those four notes. And it feels, when the chorus finish, it feels like you've had this transformative journey that has taken you to a point where that has been turned from a murky minor idea and has been, there's a catharsis of like major, beautiful, really, really expressive ending to it that feels very positive. And then the orchestra comes back in after this beautiful a cappella ending, which is not an ending, and it plays the theme again from the beginning in this sort of haunting way that it's exactly the same as the beginning. It hasn't gone anywhere, it hasn't changed. And then the piece comes to rest with a quiet minor chord that sort of says that nothing has, in the end, nothing has hugely changed from the beginning. It's the same idea as the beginning, and it's written in the same way, and we don't get the sort of catharsis of it finishing in the major key. But we did have that, but then it's sort of taken away with this slight, with the little coda at the end. I haven't got any idea what that means or why he decided to do it. I don't know. But it feels like, whilst there is positivity in the ending, there's also a sense of a resignation, I guess, maybe.
It's maybe not fair to ask you at this stage, but nevertheless,
try me.
Are there ambitions that you have for the choir? Are there things that you'd particularly like to achieve?
There's so much music that I would love to hear this choir singing. There are so many pieces, way too many to list. And there are lots of things that I'd like to hear them do, and there's lots of things that I'd like to work on with them, and also with Jaime, the music director, as well. I feel like we have developed a good relationship already. We worked together last term on the Mahler. And I think he has some really interesting ideas. I think he's bringing a lot to the symphony orchestra, and I think he'll bring a lot to the chorus as well. So we've obviously got the Ravel coming up with him at the end of the season, the Daphnis and Chloe. So my main ambition is to keep working on the way that the choir sings, to develop the way that they sing, to develop the sound of the choir overall.
It's an exciting prospect, and it's also interesting, I think, that both you and Jaime are starting together at this point, which is interesting as well. So much to come. Well, we've asked a lot of you in this first interview, but it is your interview. So it's a much easier final question, really, is as a piece of choral music to represent this particular sort of point in your career, this particular stage, what would you like to hear?
Dixit Dominus by Handel. The first movement of Dixit Dominus by Handel is a piece that I have always found to be unbelievably exciting, both to sing and to listen to. And the first time I came across it, it just completely opened my ears to really thrilling, vibrant singing. I think one of the reasons I want to pick this is because, I guess, when you said I should choose something, I thought immediately about when people try and find, like, beginner pieces of classical music, pieces that will appeal to people who don't know that they like classical music yet, things that will open people's ears up to it. And this piece, I think, is something that can really open people's ears to how exciting choral singing can be, to how thrilling the sound of a choir singing can be.
Check out our website at rte.ie/lyricfm/concerts.